This harmonium is the last living instrument of its kind left in Radhadesh. It's almost dead. Yeah, it can go straight from here into the museum one day. No, okay, wait. Go away. Lift all phenomena's bottom.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So today we're having a class which is related to the studies of the college, a Bhakti Vaibhava class, or a study of a section of Srimad Bhagavatam. And we are studying first canto, chapter 17, text 1 to text 23. To do justice to really discuss so many verses, the speaker has to spend many hours to digest in these verses and summarize them. I didn't have many hours, so I'm going to do something, but I feel it's a little below what it should be. I'm sorry for that, but what to do? Normally, when I would teach in a Bhakti Vaibhava course, I would go through all the text and highlight certain sections myself and take them out. Now I can't do that, so I'm relying on some work of others. Our Bhurijan Prabhu has done a lot of work, so I brought his book, which gives overviews and summaries. I also quickly looked at the commentaries of Viswanatha Chakravarti Thakur, and I saw that Bhurijan already absorbed the essence of these commentaries, so I left that book home. But so I'll rely a little bit on Bhurijan's work. But let me first of all read the first of the 23 verses.
Sutavacha Tatrago mittunam raja Anyamanam anattava Dandahastam chavrisala Dadrise nipalanchana.
I'll go straight to the translation. Sutta Goswami said, after reaching that place, Maharaj Pariksit observed that a lower caste Sudra, dressed like a king, was beating a cow and a bull with a club as if they had no owner. Text number 2. Vrisamrinaladavalam mehantameva bibhyatam vipanam padaikene padaikena siddhantam sudratadidam. The bull was as white as a white lotus flower. He was terrified of the Sudra who was beating him, and he was so afraid that he was standing on one leg, trembling and urinating.
Gam chadarmadugam dinam brisam sudra padahatam vivatsam atravadanam ksamam javanam itchatim.
Translation. Although the cow is beneficial because one can draw religious principles from her, she was now rendered poor and calfless. Her legs were being beaten by a Sudra. There were tears in her eyes and she was distressed and weak. She was hankering after some grass in the field. Text 4. 4.
Prapracharatam aruda karta vasvara parichadam mega gambiraya vacha samarupita karmukaha.
Maharaj Pariksit, well equipped with arrows and bows, seated on a gold embossed chariot, spoke to him the sudra with a deep voice, sounding like thunder. Text 5.
Kastvam macharane loke baladvam siyalavan bali mara naradevo siveshena natavat karmana dvija.
Oh, who are you? You appear to be strong, and yet you dare to kill within my protection those who are helpless. By your dress you post yourself to be a godly man, king, but by your deeds you are opposing the principles of the twice-born Kshatriyas.
All right, so we are beginning to look at a situation. The situation where Maharaj Pariksit encountered Kali in his otherwise very good kingdom. It is mentioned in these verses that he had a very good kingdom. So Maharaj Pariksit was very surprised to see that such a thing was going on. It was totally unexpected. The very last thing, he was shocked. It was not at all the situation. If we would see such a thing today, we kind of would expect that. You can expect anything nowadays in terms of the symptoms of Kali. So if we see some degraded activity, we are already mentally prepared. Yeah, that's the way it is. But in that kingdom of Maharaj Pariksit, the actions of Kali were so out of the ordinary that he was amazed. But he was by no means negligent. That is an element that comes out in following verses. The element comes out that Maharaj Pariksit is fully equipped and fully attentive to his duty. So there's no question of negligence. He is right there at the right moment, and he doesn't give Kali an inch. Today we are discussing the first portion of this chapter, and it leads up to the point where a discussion begins to take place between Maharaj Pariksit and the Bull Dharma. We have seen now the situation. The Bull Dharma is standing there, his three legs broken, the last leg still standing but trembling. So we are aware that these four legs are representing the qualities of cleanliness, compassion, austerity, and finally truthfulness. And we see that the one last leg that is still standing is the leg of truthfulness. But it is shaking. Srila Prabhupada explains that actually it means that truthfulness is no longer being followed or adhered to, but it still has some esteem. It still has some public recognition. Of course, everyone lies, but if you publicly get exposed as a liar, it is sort of still losing face. To that extent, there is still an external semblance of holding the truth in a high esteem, although in reality, that there is no such thing as presenting the truth. And no one is expected to present the truth at this stage. That's not the common standard anymore. So that is what we understand, how the leg is trembling. It is surrounded by many opposing
elements that are constantly attacking that truthfulness. So within the social life, on all levels,
on levels of
leadership or just the general standard, the white lie, truth is far from a principle that is applied. Subsequently, we see both Dharma and the bull and the cow are being attacked. These bulls and cows in this narration are to be seen as, yes, representing all bulls and cows that in the age of Kali are under attack and are being exploited, which is the end of a peaceful way of life. Life in the mode of goodness is based on this principle of protecting cows and bulls. And whenever cows and bulls are not in the center of society, and when protection of these animals is not the center of society, then there will be many influences of passion and ignorance in that society. Of course, in a transcendental movement, we may utilize the products that come from ignorance and passion and engage them in transcendental service, such as a car, such as a drill, or such as the kitchen these days, which sort of makes noises like ping, which obviously is not the mode of goodness, where one finds that different fires are described. One can cook on a fire of cow dung, one can cook on wood fire, one can cook on coal, then one can cook on gas, and so on. And each time, the quality of the fire goes down. And if the same cooking pots, one can... the best is to cook in clay pots and just dispose of them. Cow dung fire and clay pots. I mean, that's the perfection, actually. That's how you get the best quality of fire, the best quality of pots. Whereas then different metals are also classified in different ways. Aluminium being very low and practically toxic. And so on. So we see that in a culture of goodness, where the cow is protected, there the entire atmosphere becomes favorable for spiritual life. If we start to engage too many products of the mode of ignorance and passion, or products of Ugra Karma, or as Prabhupada writes in earlier purports, the factories he calls the dungeons of the demons, which I kind of like, nice phrase. And then he describes that all the products coming from these dungeons are Ugra Karma products. So Ugra Karma means horrible work meant to destroy the world. So when we take the products of Ugra Karma, we can use them for transcendental purposes. Cars, computers, you name it, phones, whatever. But they don't fully lose their Ugra nature. A car, even used in Krishna's service, is still an aggressive machine. A computer still gives you square eyes and still drains the brain and whatnot, and so on. Yeah, so that's interesting. So therefore, ultimately, our movement will have to come to the point when we are
maturing, then we'll have to put cow protection more and more in the center. Because we can understand that we start this movement, started like a transcendental underground movement in the middle of Kali's kingdom. At our time, the Kali's influence had very much progressed from this first meeting with Maharaj Pariksit and got a complete hold on society. But then, as an underground movement, the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya appears, and gradually comes above ground, gradually becomes more and more established above ground, and gradually begins to change, begins to take a socially established position. In the beginning, this movement had nothing, no establishment, staying in temporary residences, then gradually castles were obtained and so many other elements were obtained. These days we see progress in the academic field. In the future we can expect many aspects of this movement to develop. We may see devotees entering into a professional sphere. We may also see monastic orders develop where monks who kind of fully dedicate themselves to the spirituality are residing a little bit away from the world. We may see it all. I met recently some months ago in South Africa, a professor from Los Angeles who is interested in chaplaincies, and a chaplain is an academic certified position in America. Chaplains are widely part of social life. Chaplains are involved. They represent a religious tradition. They are involved in either counseling or promoting religious vision and so on. They get paid salaries between $30,000 and $50,000 a year if they are certified by the American Chaplaincy Association, the ACA, and so on. And it is another field where devotees can come above ground, can establish themselves in the world. I was talking with, we had some discussions about this matter in South Africa with this professor who's interested in creating Hindu chaplains, since the Hindu society remained behind by the Christians and the Muslims, who have many already. All right, just to illustrate a little bit how gradually this movement may penetrate into the modern society and take more and more places within the establishment. But at one point, obviously, we have to come back to this basic design of the sacred cow and bull and a society and a culture surrounded around a protection. It provides blessings, it provides appropriate foodstuffs, and it provides a appropriate condition for the earth, and in this way it can provide a peaceful lifestyle. So, okay, that much about cows and protecting of the cows. Then the cow and bull are also not ordinary cows and bulls in this narration. The bull is Dharma. And the cow is, of course, representing the earth, the deity of the earth.
So we see they are deities, and here in this narration, then we're looking at how these deities are suffering under the influence of Kali, and how the condition of the earth is becoming greatly destructive and or destroyed, and how we are how it becomes very difficult to find a way of life. Sometimes I address this point that I meet people, devotees, who express that they have spiritual difficulties. And actually, when I analyze the situation, I see they don't have spiritual difficulties. They are just in unsupportive social circumstances. The odds are so much against them that spiritual life becomes extremely difficult. And that's actually oftentimes the root. Of course, Srila Prabhupada understood that immediately and saw the need of creating communities, sheltered spiritual communities. But, of course, we had a problem which is typical for the age of Kali, and which Srila Prabhupada addresses in his purports, and that is the breakdown of authority. That in the age of Kali, the concept of authority no longer stands. First of all, because the authorities are no longer trustworthy. Kali is dressed like a king, but he is not. But his deeds are opposing the principles of the twice-born Kshatriyas, stated in text number 5. And that is the problem. Therefore, gradually, when all the leaders have become corrupted, then naturally no one trusts their leaders, and then everyone begins to rely on himself. And when people begin to rely on themselves, then weakness sets in. There may be sincerity, but there is weakness, because the inherent design is yat yat acharati shrestha tat tat eva taru janaha. Whatever the great man will do, others will follow. And those dynamics are required. That's not... And therefore, when proper leadership is not there, people do start looking for some kind of leadership. And if they are not having faith in the genuine authority, then they, in the formal authority, all right, then look for some alternative authority. Find some sort of authority. Therefore, we have all kinds of people who have come up, like authorities in all kinds of fields. If you have no faith in a doctor, then you can go to some quack, and he will give you some alternative approach to medicine, and yes, and we are great believers, and so on, because we want to believe. We want to believe in something. We need to believe in something. So, in that way, Srila Prabhupada's books are such a relief. Because here we are sure, we're 100% sure, we're dealing with real authority. And that is why this movement is very attractive. Because at the very root of it, there is genuine authority. Someone who knows. I always like that example that Prabhupada says, that when mundane scholars have declared the Hare Krishna movement as dogmatic, and said that, you know, the belief that Krishna is God is dogmatic, and it's limiting, you know, it's limiting, and saying God has this particular form and he's this way, and it's just, it automatically excludes many other types of belief. Yeah. So it's narrow. Yeah. As soon as you say Krishna is God and he's blue and he plays a flute or whatever, then immediately
you exclude so many others, and therefore you are dogmatic. Dogmatic. And Prabhupada's answer to that was very nice. The answer was, why are they so dogmatically saying that Krishna is not God when they haven't seen him? And he just turned the tables completely. And it was really brilliant. Brilliant, because it's true. It exposed that they are dogmatically saying Krishna is not God. Dogmatically means in the sense of they are jumping to all kinds of conclusions without having any actual evidence to underbuild their ideas, and in this way presenting a narrow-minded view of the facts. So this whole very so-called broad religious vision, Prabhupada, which is typical for Kali Yuga, right? Everything goes, and we embrace everyone's idea, and this is the ultimate of broad-mindedness. And Prabhupada just exposes, this is actually your narrow-minded, dogmatic approach, because it's not based on knowledge. It's based on your own assumptions. And, you know, nobody knows. It's based on nobody knows, and therefore everything goes. Right? Yeah. But we see that Prabhupada knows. He knows. So, okay, that makes this movement, based on Srimad Bhagavatam, very wonderful, because we have, again, real authorities. But then, because of our Kali Yuga conditioning, we have to learn to again take shelter. See, because we have to learn to again trust. It's very difficult because we have for so long not trusted, come from a culture of no trust. And therefore, to really take shelter of authority is difficult. That is our misfortune. Then come a number of verses. I was at text number 5. I jump forward a little bit. And Maharaj Pariksit is stating that the cow needs to no longer lament, nor the bull. There is no need to fear this low-class sudra in text number 9. Oh, mother cow, as long as I'm living as the ruler and subduer of all envious men, there is no cause for you to cry. Everything will be good for you. Maharaj Pariksit is a fully qualified and potent head of state. He is completely clear in what is proper and what is not proper. He fully knows religious principles. He has all the military power that a ruler requires. So there is really nothing obstructing Maharaj Pariksit to execute his duty. And therefore, when he is offering protection to the cow and the bull Dharma, it's not at all just boasting or a hollow phrase. He's not here advertising his glories beyond what he can live up to, as modern politicians will do. It's not part of a campaign. It's true. He can really reassure the cow and bull. Now I'm here. Now it's over. This your ordeal is over, basically. That is correct. And still, as the story unfolds, we see that Kali, somehow or other, manages to survive the situation. Kali is about to be killed now. That's it. Maharaj Pariksit is ready. This man is to be killed. And he acts as a Kshatriya, or he dresses like a Kshatriya and acts like a low-class man,
death is the appropriate action now. So Kali's impending death is getting closer, but it doesn't happen. And not only that, Kali somehow or other manages to avoid Maharaj Parikshit. So that's very interesting, and that is coming in not in today's section of the chapter. So that will save for later on. But that's an interesting mystery in the whole story. How did Maharaj Parikshit fail? And he failed. Kali, we all have noticed that Kali was not killed. And so how come he failed? Although he had all the qualification. So that question we only ask now and answer later. I'll continue and... here leading up to the second part of our verses that we're discussing today, which start at text 18, but I'll start reading at text 16. It is the supreme duty of the ruling king to give all protection to law-abiding citizens and to chastise those who stray from the ordinances of the scriptures in ordinary times, when there's no emergency. All right, so there is an element of apat dharma. Srila Prabhupada mentions apat dharma in the purport and speaks about Vishwamrita, who once, in a case of famine, ate the flesh of a dog just to survive. And the example of apat dharma. Srila Prabhupada once commented on apad dharma and mentioned that it is at a time of emergency one may break the ordinary religious principles, but it is said with the permission of the spiritual master, actually. Anyway, there is some room. So if you ever... now there's the movie The Life of Pi, and Pi is a pious Hindu who is getting stuck in a boat with... He's devoted to Vishnu, and he gets stuck in a boat with a tiger somehow or other on the Atlantic Ocean, a lifeboat. So it is a very complicated matter. And at one point, there is nothing to eat, and Pi eats fish to save his life. Okay, apat dharma. And not that after that he continued to eat fish for the rest of his life. He doesn't. Pi is actually only show. It comes out, the principle of apat dharma, and that he's doing this only as a principle of emergency. Now, whether we, as a transcendental movement, as members of a transcendental movement, would eat the fish or not, one could also simply say, okay, I'll fast, I'll leave it up to Krishna. I'll keep my purity, and if I'm meant to live, I'll live. And if I'm meant to leave my body now, then I'll leave it, but in a pure state. Why would I... unnecessary prolong my stay in the material world, and at the expense of sacrificing my purity, that I vowed to follow these principles, and I'll follow them, and under all circumstances, even if it would mean I would die, then let me die. I think personally I would go for that option. I would vote for that one and just stick with that. Because ultimately you have to die anyway, and what's the point? You eat the fish and you live another 20 years, and then you will anyway be there, and then it's on the bill, We still have an unpaid fish on the bill, you see. So I would be content and say, well, but that was apadharma, we didn't have to pay for that one. Well. Yeah.
So
there is an element of risk. So from the pure transcendental platform, therefore, one to automatically apply Appadharma is sort of an issue. But Prabhupada, Satsarup Maharaj addresses this point at length in his book called Diary of the 70s, ISKCON Diary of the 70s, I think it is. And there he is referring to discussion with Srila Prabhupada on the matter. And the final word is, with the permission of the spiritual master. Oh, that's an interesting little, at least I highlighted one purport. Then we come to text number 18. And the Bodh Dharma is there, he already starts speaking in 17. He says, the personality of religion said, these words just spoken by you befit a person of the Pandava dynasty. Captivated by the devotional qualities of the Pandavas, even Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead, performed duties as a messenger. So Dharma is acknowledging the qualification of Maharaj Pariksit. And then he continues, O greatest among human beings, it is very difficult to ascertain the particular miscreant who has caused our sufferings, because we're bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. I forgot to ask the question. Maharaj Pariksit's question is, of course, who has done it? That is, we can also see Maharaj Pariksit is there with his sword, but he's careful. Although a king may, in the course of his religious duty, kill, he is very careful and responsible about it, and he's by no means just taking that lightly. Therefore, obviously Kali looks like the culprit. He stands there with a stick in his head. Right? He was beating the cow. Right? But possibly he was not the perpetrator. I mean, you could think of a scenario. There was someone else who had broken the legs of the bull Dharma, who ran away, and then his helper, Kali, continued but didn't actually break the legs. I mean, you could write a scenario like that. Right? Not likely, but the king makes sure. So the king, although his duty is to kill for religious principles, we see that the kings are very careful, right? For various reasons. A, that to uphold the principles of Dharma is a very sensitive matter, and killing is generally speaking to be avoided, and only in extreme circumstances to be applied. So kings are careful in this regards. Kings are also, whatever a leader, a king or any other administrative head, whatever mistakes he makes in the course of his administrative decisions, he cannot say, well, you know, I'm not responsible. On a personal level, I'm not responsible because that is part of my profession. That is risk. That is just a risk in my profession. And, you know, you're going to make some mistakes. Human beings make mistakes, and therefore it's going to happen that I'm going to make some mistakes, and therefore I should not be held accountable. No, the king is held accountable. There may be an element of extenuating circumstances that are considered. Right? But if the king kills a person who is innocent, the king is held responsible. It may not be the same as outright murder, but still the king will get reactions for this. Yes? And that's not only in killing, but that is in every action. In offenses. I have thought about this in my years that I was in management myself, because sometimes in passion strong disagreements arise, and then sometimes strong words are spoken about these disagreements, and but even when in management there are reactions, personal reactions for such public actions. It's tricky because one might think, well, you know, this is part of the natural course of, you know, activities that a manager just gets involved in. No, the principles of Vaishnava apparat also apply within the course of administration. So, not that the administrators should avoid strong action, but they must be thoughtful, like Maharaj Pariksit. I think that's also an important point to highlight. And then we get to the conclusion. We're reading today verse 18 to 23, and there I'll take Burijan's book, because I looked at the commentaries, and then I saw that that Burijan really summarized them nicely. He took the highlights out of the commentaries and you know, the obvious points, and okay, so then I am. So, a little bit from the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur on text number 18, where the Bull just basically said that it was difficult to ascertain the miscreant because we are bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. So, Dharma the Bull. And if you say, how can you not know your tormentor when I see him right here? I say, yes, he is the tormentor, Klesada, the one who gives suffering, but there must be some seed of my torment, Klesa Beach, planted by previous deeds. Otherwise, I would not be suffering in this way. I do not know the identity of the person who generated that seed, Maharaj Pariksit. But aren't you knowledgeable in Shastra? How then can you not know? Dharma, it is true that I am knowledgeable in Shastra, but my knowledge of many Shastras leaves the cause uncertain. I am bewildered by the various opinions of the different wranglers. So, okay, there is then the Klesada and the Klesabija. So, the Klesada, the cause, the one who gives the suffering, and there's Klesabija, the seed of the suffering, and the two are not the same. So, yes, so many things are Klesada, or so many personalities are Klesada. So many things cause us, give us suffering, but then we must look at the Klesabija. What is the seed of this suffering? So that is Dharma's approach, and that is a dharmic approach. And we have to train ourselves to look not only at Klesada, right? Adiatmika kles, adidaivika, adibhautika kles, or suffering from body and mind, suffering from other living beings, suffering from natural circumstances. And we can constantly look at the klesada. Oh, it's cold. Oh, the government. Oh, my neighbors. Oh, so many things. Klesada. So everyone has his klesadas, you know, constantly. And yeah, in Amsterdam, we call it conqueror. Yeah? Constantly, we are just lamenting and just exposing all the things that give us suffering all the time. Yeah? So the dharmic approach is, and the devotee approach is, we must train ourselves to look at Klesa Beach. To look at the deeper cause. And Klesa Beach means, well, what is this seed? What is this seed? So that is the first point. Okay, there is a little more about the Shastra, and that there are so many opinions also in different Shastras that just to get it from Shastra is also not so easy. It's still confusing. then a little more. No, leave that for a moment. So anyway, we are looking at the seed, and the seed is can be different things. I'm just just seeing, where did he summarize that? He didn't. Okay, now I do it then from memory. Because there was a nice little list in the commentary.
In the commentary, it was said that the Mimamsakas, they say it's all karma. They say karma is supreme. They say that if there's a God, then he is also subjected to the law of karma. The law of karma rules above everything. That is the karmic idea. Others say no. It's that the impersonalists are saying no, it is not karma. Ultimately, it is all because the impersonalist will say jagat mitya. He will say the universe is false. So karma relates to the false universe. Therefore, how can it be karma, says the impersonalist? All it can be is atma. It can only come from the soul itself. So the cause is the soul. So different causes for what is the true bija of suffering are being referred to. Then there are the lokatayas. These are a particular materialistic group of philosophers who existed in Vedic times but were non-Vedic and who basically saw only matter as a cause of anything and nothing beyond it. So, okay, the materialist will just say, yes, it's just the interaction of the modes of nature or of the material nature. So, like this, different Dharma is hinting at different causes. Now, what Dharma is doing, Dharma is saying that is asking Maharaj Pariksit to answer his confusion. So in a way, Dharma is bringing Maharaj Pariksit to the forefront to actually give the proper conclusion. So it's not necessarily the case that Dharma did not know the conclusion. It may well be that Dharma is here divinely inspired and is pushing Maharaj Pariksit forward here to establish what is actually the proper understanding here as to the real cause of things. Obviously, there may be multi-level of causes. There may be. There is a karma, a karma bija, or a klesa bija. There is a seed to the suffering that we undergo that has nothing to do with the perpetrator. But that does not diminish the responsibility of the perpetrator in any way. I once saw in Vrindavan, I saw this dog was sleeping and it was very hot. So the dog was sleeping not far from the pump, the hand pump, where the ground is a little cool and wet. So this dog is in deep sleep, and then this little girl went to get water with the pump, you know, and she takes the big pot of water on her head and suddenly she turns around and pours the thing over the head of the dog. And I tell you, that dog almost drowned. It was on the land. I mean, there was water coming out of this dog's nose, its mouth. It is inconceivable how this dog almost drowned, you know. Yeah, looking at this and saying, my God, what's going on here, right? It's like, you know, these dogs in Vrindavan, they're really getting some purification, right? You know, to become a dog in Vrindavan means you were a devotee who somehow or other did something not quite right and have to go through this hellish life as a dog in Vrindavan. I say, like, and what about the girl, you know? I mean, was the girl an instrument of Krishna? Is he Is he culpable? Is he Brijabasi? Is he directly controlled by Krishna here? Was it the super soul dictating it? Or is the girl here a perpetrator? And is the dog being relieved in this situation? Well, the girl is actually getting herself more entangled in future suffering and so on. It's so complex, these things, right? So the multiple causes of what is taking place. The dog was in the end clearly better off, and the girl was possibly worse off in the situation. Right? So that's interesting, that the one who appears to lose in the situation is actually winning, and the one who appears to be winning is actually losing in these kind of karmic interactions. Those are interesting principles. But whatever may be, we're focusing for a moment on Kali, the perpetrator. And he, whether there was a bija, a further seed, right, that led to all the suffering that Dharma had to go through, and that therefore it was due to one's own activity, doesn't matter. The culpability of the perpetrator remains. So Dharma's arguing was all good and well, but he may have identified further causes, but it did not diminish the sense of responsibility of Kali by any means. Kali could not have justified his act and said, well, it was the karma of that bull anyway. I mean, in fact, you know, I just suddenly felt like doing this, and it wasn't even me. It was dictated from above. Like Charles Manson, who killed Sharon Tate and said to the court, it was dictated from within. It was a divine dictation in the matter. But that is no defense. That defense does not stand before Yamaraj. The perpetrator is fully culpable. So, Kali had to be killed. Really. I mean, if you're looking at it, Maharaj Pariksit, after ascertaining the facts, should come now to the conclusion of killing Kali. That's what he should do. And tomorrow, I guess, we're going to see if Maharaj Pariksit is going to kill Kali. And, it looks like Kali didn't die. And it looks like he's still alive. So somehow it looks like he got away. So that mystery is yet to be unraveled, to be continued. And then the commercials. So we stay with this episode, and we'll certainly entertain your questions or comments on today's section. Anybody who would like to respond? I was seeing Tatvavit taking notes and already started to feel hot. Yes, Tatvavit.
At the very beginning, the verse talks about the cow who was afraid. The cow was urinating and standing on one leg. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to be confused with the idea of Dharma standing on one leg.
Allegorical.
Some kind of.
Yeah, you know, it's like, as you say, it's a. Are we to look at the whole story like an allegorical story? In a way, it's interpreted like that, and the acharyas are also explaining that, like, when the four legs go down, that it actually goes by prayuga, right? That in. Okay, now I have to really. Didn't do my homework and dredge the memory. In Satya Yuga, what went down was cleanliness, I think.
Lochan Das Thakur gets into this in the Chaitanya Mangala as a section. Whatever, we see how these four qualities are going, or these three qualities are going down in subsequent yugas. Each yuga, you lose one leg. Right? So then it's a symbolic thing, and it takes place over a long period of time. The degradation is not on the spot, but it's a gradual thing. So in that kind of metaphorical vision, yeah, it is a process that takes place over a lot of time. But then there's the literal element. And Prabhupada always encouraged us to take the Bhagavatam very literal and historical, and to not go for this kind of mythological interpretation of the Bhagavatam. So I wouldn't do that. I would think that somehow or other, it basically means the bull was, or the cow was lying down and was trying to still get up. I mean, standing, you know, only on one leg means basically lying down. And still trying to get up, and that's what you call standing on one leg for a cow or a bull. So we can imagine that it is physically possible, and I think for the sake of not opening the door to say that a section of the Bhagavatam is factual and another section of the Bhagavatam is mythological, and which is that Adunikavat philosophy, you know, Sukhavak has written about that, came from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Krishna Samhita. Once you get into that area, say a portion of the Bhagavatam is mythological. Did Priyavrata really cut, you know, to create the seven ayans, the seven dvipas with the wheels of his chariot? Or is this mythology? You know, I mean, obviously, it reeks of mythology. This also may reek of mythology. But I think to be on the safe side, as a follower of Srila Prabhupada, I would say, let's take it factual. Yeah. It happened, it physically took place, and yet there was a whole... They were not ordinary cows and bulls. It was Dharma and the earth, the deity of the earth. And therefore, there was a whole deeper symbolic meaning to it also.
About the lying perpetrator pointing at somebody in the Bhagavad Gita, it's stated with the point that the same position as the perpetrator himself. I usually explain that yes, this is if you're not in the position, then it's like that. And otherwise, is that a correct explanation? And I have some other questions.
Say it again.
Sorry. So,
if you're not in the position?
Yes, if you're not in the position to be pointing at a perpetrator, in this situation, then what is explained in the Bhagavad Gita applies.
Well, I don't know. I think everybody, there is a social responsibility. You know what I'm saying? If you see someone beating a child, if you see an adult beating a child, you know, like you have as a citizen, you have some moral responsibility. If you can do something, you have a duty to do something. You cannot just say, well, I'm not an authority, I have nothing. So every human being, we have a human responsibility, you know, like and then authorities have a further responsibility, obviously. But
so to what extent do you endeavor when something happens to you to find a perpetrator?
Yeah, I think so. A Vaishnav mentality is to simply to not so quickly point at a perpetrator. I came across, there is a verse in this section which says that the one who points at the perpetrator will attain the same destination as the perpetrator. Yeah. So that kind of mentality of like revenge and going after someone is being referred to there. But sometimes we have a social duty. For example, if say someone is there's an attempt of murder on us, say, then you get all kinds of questions coming up. And one question is, now should I just look at this from a broader perspective and say, well, the ultimate cause is Krishna, and Krishna's sanctioned it, the ultimate cause is Krishna, and is accepted as Krishna's mercy. Or, and say, anyway, you know, I survived it, what do I... It's the perpetrators will get punished by Krishna. Yeah, but you also have a social responsibility, and there's someone with a dangerous mentality on the loose. Yeah. So, you know, like, if the person did it to you, he may do it to someone else also. So, therefore, there are all kinds of ethical issues coming up. So you cannot just say, no, I will never point at a perpetrator. So, therefore, you cannot fix this in one general rule and say, this is the principle that applies to all situations. No. If it's not so serious, let it go. If it is very serious, then for the sake of protecting society at large, protecting the greater community, we may have to point at the perpetrator. Yeah. So it's complicated. I'm definitely stopping at 9 o'clock, or maybe now. Okay, last.
About the
what?
The Vishnu on the boat who eats meat.
The life of Pi.
And I was wondering, because you say it's better to die purely without eating meat and fish.
Well,
just in case. But my question is, we kill so many living entities anyway. So what about that?
Yeah. Well, that's true, we do, but the unavoidably, right? So there's the unavoidable killing, and then there is the choice to kill. So that's where something changes. Yeah. But it is no hard and fast conclusion in this matter, that I'm saying. I guess it's... unless your spiritual master tells you to very strictly, forget it, you know. Even if you're in the lifeboat with a tiger, you can't eat fish. Yeah? Unless he tells you that, it's like... there is that opening for Appad Dharma. There is that opening. And after that, you may survive, and you may come back to land, and you may preach for another 25 years and save many conditioned souls, and you know, and Krishna may take you back to Godhead. That's possible. But others may say, anyway, you know, like, I am not the greatest agent of the mercy of the Lord. You know, the Sankirtan movement doesn't depend on me. I'm just a tiny little insignificant player. And whether I die 25 years earlier, and if some souls don't come to me, they'll come to someone else. So, you know, so forget, if I have to die now, I'll just die. Yeah. You see, so you can argue it in either way, and I'm not going to give a final conclusion. Although I will say, I choose not to eat the fish myself, for sure. I'm not going to eat it. I'll go down. Okay, let's die. Prefer that one. With that, we'll end and continue with breakfast. Thank you very much, Prabhupada Kijaj.